getting flushed down the goddamn toilet.
Yeah.
Which happens all the time without people even knowing it anyway.
That's right. 50% of pregnancies end in like miscarriage, spontaneous abortion. Yeah. It is that high. Yeah. It is that high.
Yeah. God, you see, God is a murderer. God is Hitler.
God is a mass murderer. He's a murderer.
Look at all the babies he kills all the time.
All the time. Mm.
Hi, this is Maya Garantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
Happy New Year, listeners.
Happy New Year.
It's a new year. It's a new decade. It's the 20s. We're very excited about that. To ring in the new year, we actually are going to do something we've never really done before on this show. We have a bunch of clips for you of good conversation we've had with each other and with some guests over the course of 2019 that had to be cut for length or whatever reason, and we want to share them with you.
Yeah, it's our way of doing a year-end review to share with you the wild range of topics that we covered in 2019. And it's kind of an amazing snapshot of 2019, I have to say.
In a lot of ways.
And also to encourage you guys who want to support The Sauce, there is special bonus material that usually goes to our patrons. But we are sharing a whole smorgasbord of it with our general listeners so that you can get excited for us to take on a whole host of whatever wild shit is going to come up in 2020.
So we have several clips to share. Before we jump into those clips, though, Maya, are you drinking as you're supposed to be?
I've finished my drink. What am I going to do?
You got it. Get a new one. I hear pouring. Are you
getting pouring. A new one? Let me get some booze. Hold on. I've started keeping some booze in my studio.
That's good. That's good. That's progress.
That is the sound of tequila, my friends.
Nice. What kind of tequila are you drinking?
I'm drinking El Jimador, which is solid. It's not like a sipping tequila. It's something that I kind of mix in with other things, but it's quite tasty in that respect.
Very nice. I like Jimador. It is a solid choice for tequila.
And what about you, my dear one?
I am drinking tequila also.
Ooh, very good.
Mine is a sipping tequila. It's called Pancho's El Charro Feliz.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a tequila that Matt and I bought in Cabo, because as you know, we frequently vacation in Cabo San Lucas.
Yes. Your timeshare. Yes. I know it's not a timeshare. I'm just
It's a vacation
you.
Club membership. And we love this one restaurant, Pancho's. It's really fun. We did a tequila lesson there. We got our tequila certificate as tequila tasters.
Wow.
And we, on our last trip, bought this bottle of their they have a distillery that makes it for them, but it has their name on it. And I liked it enough to buy it, which is not saying little. You know, I drink a lot, but I'm picky with my liquor dollar. I try to spend it as wisely as possible. So if you get down to Cabo and get a chance to try Pancho's, I recommend. The first clip we're going to share, do you want to set it up, Maya?
Mm-mm.
No, you want to take a sip of your drink, so go for that. The first clip we're going to share is from an episode we posted in August of this past year, 2018. And it was about those 1980s powerful women TV shows.
What we were calling shoulder pad feminism.
That's a good term. I like that.
A certain kind of 80s, hey, powerful feminism that doesn't seem to be working so well anymore.
Right.
And we were talking about Sex and the City as this kind of avatar of that, at least in television, is that that was this big performance of that kind of feminism. And then who were the inheritors of Sex and the City? And so we talk about the kind of generational differences in the inheritors of that kind of women's show about women and sex and finding yourself.
Being powerful and
yes.
And also white.
Yes.
One thought that occurred to me was I was wondering who has taken the mantle from Sex and the City and sort of carried that shoulder pad feminism forward, like well past the era of shoulder pads. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the show Girls.
Who?
Yeah, because it's clearly not that, but it has its roots in that in a really interesting way. And I full disclosure, I have watched like 3 episodes of Girls in my entire life. So I'm not the best person to talk about it, but I did see the first episode and I've seen a couple others. And in the first episode, they have a joke where the one girl who's supposed to be the youngest and most naive is a big fan of Sex and the City.
Uh-huh.
And she's, have you seen it? Have you watched Girls? You've watched Girls.
You know what's crazy? I have never watched Girls.
Didn't we talk about an episode, a specific episode of Girls on this show? No.
I've never watched Girls.
Okay.
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay.
Or maybe I just played along. I've actually never watched it. Yeah.
So you have Girls is 4 white women living in New York, trying to make a go of things, dating various men. You know, one of them's kind of a girly traditionalist, kind of basic. One of them's a writer, a little bit bohemian.
Right.
One of them's like the professional career girl, and one of them's like the libertine.
Okay.
Does it all.
Sex in the City. Sex in the City. Right, right.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So in the first episode, you have the one who is the naive one and who you're supposed to understand as being really goofy and silly talk about how much she loves Sex in the City, and isn't this just like Sex in the City? And you're supposed to be laughing at this and be like, this is not like Sex in the City. It's the opposite of that. And you know, clearly the show is...
It's abject and it's like kind of, yeah.
The show
is
hanging a lantern on its obvious similarities to Sex in the City. But it rings hollow in certain ways because it is so clearly a very similar show. And I think it's fascinating to think about the ways in which it's similar and the ways in which it's different. I mean, one of the more obvious being that the whole theme of this is that they're trying to make it as young 20-somethings who don't really have an income yet.
Right.
As opposed to Sex in the City, where
right.
the money just is always there, basically.
It's all been made already.
Yeah. But there's also, I think, a generational thing that I'm trying to put my finger on with Girls that has to do with an attitude about themselves. In Girls, the characters often do things that are just terrible. They are not good people.
Right.
They do things that are stupid and selfish and terrible. And sometimes they do things that are wonderful. I mean, I've seen 3 episodes, but like, I have the gist of it. And I think that there's a kind of, it's like a self-deprecating quality.
Yes.
That you don't ever see on Sex and the City. Although maybe it's a different self-deprecating quality on Sex and the City.
Yeah, Sex and the City.
They sort of recognize that they're sluts and that they're shallow and stuff like that. But they're just having fun with it. And Girls is more self-deprecating. It's just like, aren't we awful? Aren't we just awful millennials? Don't we suck? In a way that I feel like is very millennial.
Yes. I mean, it reminds me of this one. I had a friend who was in line at the Broad at the museum here in LA. Mm-hmm. And this one girl, this like UCLA girl, like cut it in front of him in line. And like, he'd been waiting for like 2 hours at this point. And he's like, I'm sorry, excuse, I'm in fucking like, hello. And he was finally like, don't you feel embarrassed that you are this shitty? And she was like, I mean, yeah, but I'm not going to let that ruin my day.
That's amazing.
And that, I think about that, I'm like, that's a millennial right there.
I want to get that embroidered on a pillow. That's inspirational.
I'm not going to let that ruin my day.
That's
Come
great.
On.
That's you amazing. Know?
Fuck that.
So Girls has its own sort of weird take on this, where it's not quite that independent, materialistic, shoulder pad wearing thing. It's sort of a different idea about white women that I think there are more overlaps and connections than that show wants to admit. But who really is carrying the torch?
In a very different way, I feel like when you talk about Girls, you have to talk about Broad City. Because Broad City is like Girls plays with abjection,
yeah,
but in a seriously abject way from what I've heard, whereas Broad City is kind of like
what I like to call the exuberant abject.
Yes.
It's like abject, but it's completely, it's happy and it's great. Yeah. And like, they aren't bad. Show. They aren't bad people. Right. They're great people. They're just fucking grotesque people, but that doesn't make them bad. They're just kind of joyous and like clowns. And it's like so super joyous.
I love that show. That's a really interesting one to put in this conversation too.
September, we had an amazing guest, Kieran Scarlett.
He was great.
Oh, God, he's so good. And you should all follow him at Dan Blackroyd. He's fantastic. There are a lot of movies coming out, and I'm really excited to just watch him tweet them to shame, tweet them to filth. So we had this really amazing episode. This was inspired by a listener who asked us what we thought about increased diversity on television and whether it's real diversity or tokenism. Mm. And we sort of got into what is real diversity and what are different performances of tokenism.
That was a hell of an episode. And we had way more material than we could use.
Oh my God.
In one episode. So this particular clip is one bit that we didn't use where we got into the topic of male TV writers and kind of male writers in general, and the way that edginess and authenticity or mature writing often get conflated with writing about sexual violence or misogynistic writing generally.
Yeah.
And also looked at the different ways that male writers and directors look at lesbian stories compared to stories that are told by lesbians. It was a little bit of a meandering bit of the conversation, but I think a very interesting one.
Yeah. I mean, I think most of our episode was really focusing on race, and this was kind of this, like, we veered off into gender and specifically into women and how women's stories are told.
Yeah. That was more concise. Well done.
I like Handmaid's Tale a lot, and I think that the season that just ended last week was very, like, I thought it was incredible. And also, I think that Hulu kind of nailed it perfectly. They kind of did what Netflix probably wanted to do but was too afraid to do, where they were releasing episodes weekly instead of just all at once to see what that would look like, and it worked out well for them. Like, the first streaming service to win the Primetime Emmy for Best Drama Series was not Netflix, it was not Amazon, it was Hulu with A Handmaid's Tale. Right. And you can argue that the only reason that they won was because Game of Thrones was off that year. And that's a horrible thing to say, but I mean, like, they had such a stranglehold.
And then, like, the stranglehold, actually, A.S. Hamra, who's the great film critic who writes for N+1, was just here in L.A., and he gave a talk because he has this book out called The Earth Dies Streaming, and he was talking about, like, Game of Thrones and how it just has inspired the worst writing ever, which I don't agree with. But Game of Thrones is the most, in terms of, like, gender, it is the most basic, like, it is so white, it is so hetero, it is so, it's such a basic melodrama. It's a big fantasy melodrama, but it's not like it's pushing any boundaries in that way. And that was, like, the big show. That was the show that everybody talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was in a screenwriting program, and I definitely was in rooms with male writers. And male, especially straight male writers, and I don't want to just put this on straight male writers because I think this is all male writers across the board have this problem, but it really is this thing where they would literally suggest, oh, you should add a rape scene. Like, that would make this more interesting. And I'm like, that's not how you do that, first of all.
That's really fascinating to hear, because Maya's interview that she referred to earlier, that's in a bonus episode for our patrons about Game of Thrones, that was one of the points that you and Sarah Mesley were making, Maya, was not just that boobs mean prestige, but sexual violence against women, typically, it's almost always women, means prestige.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this in terms of comic books today, because this is so true in comic books, that if you put a rape, then it's for grown-ups.
Oh, God.
Then it's a serious, important... And, like, that started with Frank Miller and Alan Moore in the 80s. And it just sort of continues. I mean, it sort of had its peak in the late 90s, early 2000s, but it still continues, that sort of thing. Like, if it's a superhero comic, it's for kids. But if it's a superhero comic with rape, that's a grown-up story. Like, it's more mature and important and serious.
You know what? That's a very Jeffrey Epstein take on luxury. That's what luxury is. That's
seriously. If you follow my Twitter timeline, you know that I'm obsessed with Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That was my show when I was a teenager, and I still watch old episodes of it and talk about it. But there was an episode in the second last season where Spike tried to rape Buffy, and it was very harrowing, like, because she was injured at the time, so she wasn't at her full strength. And, you know, she's a good actress, Sarah Michelle Gellar. So it was like her on the ground, you know, our strong heroine, almost getting raped. And it was such a big deal in terms of the public not loving it. It was such a turning point in terms of the way that people viewed that character, which I never loved Spike the way that a lot of people did. They kind of romanticized him, but...
Oh, yeah. He's the bad boy that everybody wants. He's the hot bad boy.
That's really what it comes down to. But
yeah.
But after he tried to rape our heroine, it was different. And that wasn't even a rape. That was an attempted rape. And I was thinking about it, what you were just saying about Game of Thrones, and I'm like, it's so fucked up that the landscape is such now that, like, that wouldn't even make a blip, likely. Like, in the era of Game of Thrones, in the era of even stuff like, and I think it was handled better on the show for obvious reasons, and I'm loath to give Lena Dunham anything at the moment, but that scene in the second season where it's kind of ambiguous about whether Adam Driver's character raped Shiri Appleby's character, who he's dating, where they were having sex, but, like, she wasn't necessarily consenting to everything that he was doing.
Right, right.
And I think that sexual violence as an indication that the show is edgy or cutting edge with no sense of what the implications of that are. And it's funny you say, like, oh, that means it's for adults, but, like, that's such a juvenile mentality to me.
Oh, totally. Well, when I read a comic book, especially, like, a non, like, mainstream superhero comic book that has sexual violence in it, or, you know, you open the second page, it's like boobs and blood, and you're like, oh, I see. You were 12 when you first read Frank Miller, and the rest of your life you're going to be in that mindset where you think edgy means rape. It's like a juvenile male, frankly, mindset.
Yeah, I was talking about this either this morning or yesterday. The days are starting to blur together now that I'm editing all the time. But I was talking about how people call The Hours cold, and they also call Carol cold. Mm. And I was thinking about, like, queer women on film. And I'm like, oh, the movies about queer female romance are called cold when the women are over 40. Or when there's not, like, lurid depictions of sex acts. Something like Blue is the Warmest Color.
Right.
Which is directed by a man, and
who has since then been hopefully taken down or in the middle of some horrible sexual violence accusations.
Yeah, and what you're saying about, like, oh, you were 12 when you read Frank Miller. I can't pronounce the director's name, but that director was clearly, you know, at a formative age when he first saw lesbian sex and pornography. And now he thinks that's, and now as an adult male who doesn't talk to lesbians in any way that would facilitate him actually listening to them and hearing things and taking in ideas. He thinks that's how they have sex, you know? He thinks that they have sex for a male audience.
Right.
Okay, I really love this next clip. I love all of these, truthfully, which is why they never got deleted from our files and are appearing here now. But this one, I really enjoy. It's from our episode in October that was about humanizing evildoers.
I loved that one. I'm sorry. I loved that one.
I mean, it's one that I recall fondly as well, because we talked about the media that takes men who do evil acts and tries to look at the whole dimensionality of them, refuses to see them as monsters. And one of the examples we used was Sean Spicer being on Dancing with the Stars.
Yep.
And I happened to notice that Karamo from Queer Eye was also on Dancing with the Stars the same season. And Karamo's whole thing, in a way, is kind of humanizing bigots, because he plays that role of listening, reaching out, making connections, which often overlaps with this problem that we were talking about. You know, how do we hold people accountable for bad behavior, but also acknowledge that they are people?
And in some ways, like, is that possible? In trying to see them as people, are we always going to be in some ways submitting to their horribleness? And right? It happened at the same time as David Brooks wrote this horrible column. I mean, they're all horrible, but this like this column about like
one of the
flyover
best.
Man, where it was like the mythological Trump voter in the middle of the country that those coastal liberals just don't get. So we sort of make the connections between Karamo, Sean Spicer, and David Brooks. There's the whole, I'm in a social situation. Is this where I'm going to make a scene? What does making a scene do anyway? All of that stuff. I get it. But the whole, we're people. We're just people. And that's one of the things that I think is interesting about Spicer and Dancing with the Stars is that, like, Karamo
yeah.
is another contestant.
I did not know this. I found this out from the recaps. I literally was looking up today to find out if Sean Spicer had been eliminated because I've never watched Dancing with the Stars. I've probably watched an episode. And I definitely have watched clips of certain memorable dances. But
right.
I'm not a regular viewer. So I wanted to know if he was still on. And I looked it up and I was like, oh shit, Karamo from Queer Eye is also a contestant. Right. And my first thought was like, wow, why would he agree to be on with Sean Spicer? And then I was like, oh yeah, it's Karamo.
Right.
The same Karamo who on Queer Eye pulls that shtick where he drives for an hour and a half with the Trump voting bigot so they can talk and get to know each other. And then he can conclude in the sappy end of the episode, what we've learned part, he can conclude that, you know, if we just listen to each other,
yes,
we'll see that we're not so different.
That's right.
We're all really the same, and we have more in common than we have that's different.
Yes, and when people sort of heave and pant, which they have, about normalization, uh-huh. it's like the normalization that erases the power dynamics that are real.
Yes, fucking real.
This shit is real. And you can acknowledge somebody's humanity without erasing that when you vote for someone who is going to destroy every right you have, there is in some ways no way you're going to connect, or there is an impasse. There's an impasse. That is unavoidable. And generally the way that Queer Eye deals with it, or that sort of thing deals with it, is the Fab Five are the ones, like, they're being the bigger people by getting these people to understand that they're humans.
Yeah.
And we should feel proud that they're not just disgusting animals for being gay.
They have to perform their own humanity.
Yes.
For these bigots in an attempt to sort of rescue them from their own bigotry.
Yeah.
And the thing you said about power is really, really key, because the view of a white cop that people are just demonize cops so much is not equivalent to the view of a black man that he's afraid of getting murdered by a cop.
Yes.
Those are not equivalent yes. beliefs or fears or whatever. Yes, they're connected, and I suppose it is constructive to understand both views. But to behave as though, and this is what Karamo did in the episode I'm referring to, he listened and treated this guy's concerns very seriously. And it's basically a form of coddling. It's yes. like, let me let you feel listened to. Let me hear all your dumbass reasons why right. you're a stupid fucking bigot. And I will give them credence and I will acknowledge them and so forth. And then maybe after an hour of me doing that, you might be willing to listen to my point of view and hear a different experience. And then maybe that'll open your mind.
That's right.
And through this process, we both will grow. But really, mostly you will grow.
You'll grow. Yeah. But you won't feel like you've had to grow.
Exactly. Exactly. You won't feel like you've been taught something, because that would be the worst thing.
Yeah.
For you to learn something.
Well, not just for you to learn something, but for you to have to understand that you were fucking ignorant.
For
you to understand that there was a way in which what you were was wrong. Yeah.
That's a perfect example. And it ties into, I mean, this whole last 3 years, I think, of New York Times articles about Trump voters in diners talking about their feelings about jobs and immigrants. And of course, David Brooks's recent work of sublime perfection.
Yeah, it's so David
Brooks. It's the most David Brooks thing that's ever been.
Yes.
He wrote a column in which he imagined a conversation with a Trump voter. No, he did not interview a Trump voter or talk to anyone.
No, it wasn't an actual Trump voter. It was the imaginary Trump voter in David Brooks's mind.
And he called him flyover man. And so he imagined what the coastal elitist would say, and he imagined what the flyover man would respond. I mean, there are no words. But that whole genre of, let's delve into the mind of flyover man, let's try to understand what's really going on, when actually, based on statistics and research and the best knowledge we have, it's pretty clear that what's really going on is he's a fucking racist. But yeah, like, let's waste a shit ton of ink on that. It all comes from the, I feel like, the same impulse, the same idea that it's all just political differences, and we're all humans, and if we can just get to the core of what makes us the same, we'll realize that none of these power relationships actually exist.
Yes.
Or matter. Yes.
Our next episode, we finally, and I really am surprised that it took us this long, we finally got into Russia.
Russia.
About Russia in our social imaginary. And we had this sort of meandering journey into the conversation about free will.
This conversation in this clip actually stemmed from listener feedback. A reader wrote to us in response to our previous episode about humanizing people who do evil deeds, and wanted to talk about some of these questions about accountability and choice. So it got us thinking about choice and free will and the extent to which the actions that we take, whether for good or ill, are free choices that we make, or if there might be more to it than that, and, you know, what's the difference ultimately?
Right. I remember this one play that I did. I remember being very guided by the metaphor of how, like, when you change the channel on the TV, it's this illusion of choice because you're changing the channel, but those channels have been programmed for you.
Right.
And
that's an interesting analogy. That's pretty good.
And I feel like that's what a lot of this is. I mean, I know I've told this story, but I found it really interesting that, like, I ended up sending my kid to the same hippie sort of kibbutznik preschool, and all of a sudden I ran into people from college that I hadn't seen or spoken to for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And we were all sending our kids to the same preschool.
Right.
Because there is no such thing as free will. There is class, and there are educational systems, and all of us went to the same college. And so 20 years anon, all of us want to send our kids to the same kind of preschool. It's like, it's so embarrassing in a way. It's like,
It is. I mean, I've had not similar experience, but drawn similar conclusions from my experiences, like having ADHD, which I've talked about in previous episodes a little bit. One thing that I think I've learned is that, okay, if I have a task to do and it doesn't seem like a pleasant task or a fun task, I will put it off and I will put it off and I will put it off. And I spent 40 years of my life thinking that that was a personality trait or that was a series of choices I was making. I was choosing to put it off, and I couldn't stop choosing that. I could not, no matter how much I wanted to improve my behavior. I couldn't stop choosing that. And then I look at my sister, who has what, you know, you'd call like a type A personality. If there's a task that is not yet done,
she can't sleep at night.
She cannot sleep at night. It does not sit well with her. She can't handle it. She has to get the thing done if she can, and she gets a great deal of pleasure from that completion. And you could call that our personalities or our natures. You could say we're making choices. But I honestly have come to think that what she's experiencing when there's a task to be done and what I'm experiencing when there's a task to be done are very different. We're having different neurochemical reactions to that. And it's not just biological. Obviously, there's many things to do with innate personality and experience and birth order and whatever the fuck else could be influencing who we are and how we behave. But fundamentally, the things she gets pleasure from and the things that are easy for her and fun for her are different from the things I get pleasure from and that are easy for me and fun for me. And the things that are difficult for her and that she wants to avoid are different from the things that are difficult for me and that I want to avoid. So you can say, well, this person chooses to wake up early and get all his work done and chooses to do these things that we consider to be virtuous or a good character, but it's most likely that it's actually easier for that person to do those things.
Well, okay. But then there is... No, I really feel that. I've been feeling that lately as a parent, where I look at my children and how, like, my son launched himself off play structures and landed like an acrobat at 2, and my daughter still can't, like, jump with 2 feet off the ground. Meanwhile, my daughter is writing her name and drawing at a level that my almost 9-year-old is not that much better than, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're like, why do parents think they have any control over any of this shit? They don't! Like, you don't. But there's still, when you do something where your job has an impact on other people's lives, there are still responsibilities that you take or that you accept that you take or that you should accept that you take.
Of course.
And I feel like that's where, when we're talking about these people who do terrible things, these like horrible people who do terrible things, they might be whatever they are. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, when you are going to do something that has an impact on other people's very lives, there are skills that you fucking better have.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's a really important factor not to lose sight of as we talk about these issues, because we could talk forever about what are the reasons why people make whatever choices they make.
Right.
The question really is, how do we mitigate harm? Yes. You know, does Trump act the way he acts because he just can't help it? Maybe he was born that way. Maybe it's Maybelline. You know, maybe it's spray tan. Whatever. He acts the way he acts. Is it a choice? And we need to hold him accountable for making those choices. Like, on a moral level, I don't really care that much. What I care about is creating a society that doesn't allow people like him to do harm.
Yes.
And I think part of that is, once people have done harm, figuring out how we deal with them.
Yeah.
And how we receive them. That is part of the picture of stopping future harm. And ultimately, that's what we want to be doing. This next clip comes from the episode we did in November about inspirational teacher movies.
And also, we got into the ways that the cultural conversations about inspirational teacher movies have kind of a crazy impact on actual policy.
Yeah. The impression that people have of the state of education and the problems within education and the ways to solve them are so heavily inflected by these movies. So it was a really interesting topic to delve into. In this particular segment that didn't make the episode, I was saying that the things you see in inspirational teacher movies are really not reflective of what's happening in failing urban schools and the real problems that are there. And Maya asks me, well, what are the real problems? And we got into that in some detail, not a huge amount, but it's a good clip. I will tell you that in many ways, working in a high-needs urban public school, it's worse in so many ways than you might think, but it's bad in different ways than people know.
Then what's bad? What's the thing that you're like,
I mean, we don't have time for me to get into everything, but for me, like it took me a minute to figure out a minute. It took me a year, which is how long it takes you to figure out how to manage my classroom.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't figure it out. Once I figured out how to manage the classroom, I had to deal with my administrators for the rest of my time teaching who wanted to stop me from doing whatever I was doing that was allowing me to manage my classroom. That was the gist of it. Most of the problems really came down to terrible administrators, bullying administrators, incredible, ridiculous paperwork requirements, people from the state coming through because we were at risk for being taken over by the state school. They come through every month and look around your classroom. And then you get these memos that are like, there's too many charts on the wall. They say it's overwhelming. You take down your charts. They come through the next month and literally you get a memo, more charts. We need a print-rich environment. Their job is to come through and find something to find fault with. That's their job.
Oh,
and my job is then to just like be constantly chasing my tail, trying to like have my bulletin boards look exactly the way they want them to, and also try to educate these kids who have such needs. They need so much, and I want to give it to them, but like I am one person.
Right.
So back to the topic.
Yes.
That does bring me to a point I really wanted to make, which is that in inspirational teacher movies, it's suggested most of the time that what makes the difference with this inspirational teacher is that they really believe in the students and they let them know that.
Right.
If caring about and believing in your students is what it takes to get them to turn their lives around, we wouldn't have an achievement gap.
Right.
There's no shortage of people joining Teach for America every year, starry-eyed, ready to be Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds.
Yes.
They're ready to make a difference. They believe in the kids. They love the kids.
Yeah.
If they really could make a difference, they would have by now. It's just not that simple.
And actually, I remember one friend of mine who was a teacher who was like, if I can just close my door and just teach my kids. Like, he was like, yeah, that's all I need. Just close the door and let me teach my kids.
Like, that was like my mantra when I was a teacher. That's all I wanted. Because when I was just teaching the kids, I was fucking good at it.
Right.
Look, I took this, there's this survey you can take online. Some nonprofit organization did a survey where they looked at star teachers in urban schools. They looked at Title I schools and failing schools that aren't getting good, you know, outcomes, good scores. Right. And they identified teachers whose outcomes were superior to others. And then they tried to look at what traits they had in common that were making them so much more effective. And they created this list of the qualities of the star urban teacher. And then they created a quiz where you could see which of those qualities, and it's like a lot of it is dispositions and attitudes about education. And I took the quiz and I was rated as being a star teacher potentially because I was a fucking good teacher.
Yeah.
Like I knew what I was doing. And if you let me do what I need to fucking do, the worst kid in the school is going to sit at their fucking desk and they're going to at least fucking pretend to read a book when I'm in the room because I was no nonsense bitch as a teacher, but they loved me because I was kind and I cared about them. I had all that shit going on. I cared about them like nobody's fucking business and they knew it. They still didn't fucking graduate from high school. Like even if I got them all to pass the state test, which I did not, they're still going to go on to seventh grade to some bozo who's it's their first year teaching.
Right.
They right. forget everything they learned.
Right.
So what's the fucking point?
And then finally, because it wouldn't be the sauce if we didn't ruin male geniuses.
I feel like it's the whole reason our podcast exists, like, when it comes down to it.
Why else do we exist? So just this past month, we did a 2-episode massive thing about Scorsese. Takedown of Martin Scorsese. So I ended up having a little digression about Fosse Verdon, which I had watched and had just been dying to talk about, and the ways that Fosse Verdon couldn't help itself with the male genius.
actually one thing I have to say briefly. Yes. I finally watched Fosse Verdon. Mm. And it...
I haven't seen it yet.
It's supposed to sort of rewrite the story of Fosse. And okay. It fell into this, like, if the whole point is to say Fosse did this about his own life, they wasted mm-hmm. so much time recreating Fosse's own shots. And they spent so little time on Gwen Verdon. I actually felt like it was such a failure in that way, because the whole point about Gwen Verdon is that literally Fosse did not become as great a choreographer as he could have been until she was able to do his steps better than he could ever imagine them. Mm. Like, God. There are moments where they try to get to some of that, but then it's just too easy to slip into wanting to recreate all that jazz. And it's so disappointing, because
I know, but All That Jazz. Come on.
Oh, All That Jazz is one of my favorite movies of all time. Like, I have watched All That Jazz a bajillion times. I love that movie desperately. But if the whole point of Fosse Verdon is to say, actually, all of this genius was built on the backs of him collaborating with the right women at the right time.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to communicate that.
I see what you're
saying. They
didn't
know how to, they sort of tell us, but they don't know how to show us, except in a few moments in the beginning. And it's so, it was so disappointing, because I feel like, yeah, like the point is Fosse was very talented when he was working with Gwen Verdon. And he would even say, if our life was just being in the rehearsal room, we would have stayed married forever. Like, she worked on every film he ever made all the way to the end.
But that idea that Fosse isn't Fosse without a collaboration.
Yeah.
Just doesn't, it doesn't
jive.
It's
really hard for people, even with these filmmakers making a whole series where that's the point. It was so hard for them.
Well, listeners, we love you. I really feel like we have the best listeners. I'm so psyched for you guys, and I'm psyched for this coming year, because this is make it or break it year, guys. This is existential humanity survival time. So we're very glad that we'll be seeing it through with you guys.
Right. Solidarity, if nothing else. Thank you for listening for whatever amount of 2019 you were with us. And we hope you'll continue with us in 2020. And we hope you'll reach out to us and share with us your thoughts and opinions and reactions. You can always reach us via email. We're saucepodcast@gmail.com. And of course, we are at Sauce Podcast on the Twitter and the Instagram.
You can always reach me at Maya Garance, anywhere you're looking for Maya Garances.
And me as at Gynostar on all the various platforms.
Also, don't just tell us what you think. Tell us what you want us to ruin, and we will do that for you. In fact, we've had multiple people telling us to ruin Watchmen, and we are going to do it.
We're working on it.
We're working on it.
We're going to do it.
But we are always excited. You guys give us some of our best topic ideas. So in the coming year, we are here for you.
And of course, do not forget, if you enjoyed hearing some of this bonus material and you want to hear more little clips from the cutting room floor or special short episodes, we have stuff like that for you. It is on our Patreon. Visit us at patreon.com/saucepodcast. In addition to bonus material, there's a community forum where we love interacting and chatting with you guys. So give it a visit. Consider joining if you can.
All right. Happy New Year. Be safe out there.
Happy New Year, and adios, amoebas.